Today is July 20th, 2020. My name is Noah Schoen, and I'm an interviewer with the OHSS Education Narratives Project. I'm here in Boston with Carol Murray, who is in upstate New York. And just to get started, Carol, I'd love for you to tell me a little bit about where you come from.
Sure. Thank you. I am in New York, and I've been teaching in this region in the Hudson River Valley for many, many years. But I'm actually from the West Coast. I'm from Oregon, and I came this way and found myself very comfortable in in the Hudson River Valley, which has a lot of trails and mountains and rivers, similar to where I grew up, and I've been raising my kids here. And done a lot of different types of teaching. My primary interest and specialty is young children, 0 to 5. And in this region, I've done some public school, kindergarten, first grade kind of work. I've done special education. I've done home visits with babies and toddlers. And really in the last, I guess, 15 years, I have focused on childcare. I've really primarily been a director of a child care center on a campus, campus-based child care at a community college and now at Bard College.
What was life like for you as a student growing up in Oregon?
Oh, wow. I was not a good student. I did not like school at all. I hated school. Actually, I felt really uncomfortable in school. And it's interesting to think that I chose education as a field, and I've thought about that a lot. I was the oldest of many kids, of 4 kids, and my parents were really young. My parents were 18 when I was born, and they quickly had 3 other children. And then all around me, my parents had a lot of sisters and brothers, so there were a lot of cousins. So there were a lot of kids around me all the time. And being the oldest, I think I just sort of absorbed that that sort of big sister archetype, you know, take care of other people kind of vibe, and learned actually a lot of wisdom and from watching my moms and grandparents and aunts and uncles care for children. And I think I was drawn to education from sort of a developmental perspective, more of a psychology perspective, interested in sort of how we come into the world and how we find our way in relationship to our family, and interested in that first relationship, the relationship of parent and child and care. So my childhood was very choppy. My parents were, you know, it was a childhood of poverty, and like many children who are in that boat, we moved a lot. So my dad was a logger or a mill worker, and he was in and out of work. And we moved a lot from the valley to the coast, depending on the job situation. And on top of that, he had, you know, a lot of issues with his consistent work, being that he was a young man trying to care for a family. And I think there was depression and alcoholism and those kind of things. So some people don't believe me when I tell them I lived in 32 houses between the time I was born and 18, but my mom and I have counted them up. And so my childhood included a lot of evictions and sort of abandoning places we lived, and it actually included homelessness. We lived in the woods for a while. My dad took on the task of sort of self-employment and collecting brush, and he would go up into the mountains in southern Oregon, and he would collect different types of brush and sell it to florists. Oregon is incredibly beautiful and lush, and he had fern and sal al and different types of huckleberry twigs and branches that were collectible and sellable. So he did that for a while, and we lived in the woods for a couple summers. And we also moved in with my grandparents a lot when we couldn't pay the rent. So very hard to kind of be a good student, I think, when you're moving around so much. And so, like I said, you know, my fascination, I think, with education really came from that perspective of not being a good student and thinking about what schools can be for children and what they should be for children.
You mentioned that you did learn some things from watching that your extended family care for children. I was wondering what some of those things were.
Well, as I became, you know, a teacher, and I realized that a lot of the things I was relying upon, a lot of things that made me successful with children and families, were some of those things I had inherited from my upbringing. And sometimes I would like think that, you know, there is this sort of inherited wisdom of how we care for children, how we make connections with children, and that I noticed a lot of the young people that I was mentoring or tutoring didn't seem to have those skills. And I guess really, I think probably they did have those skills, but they didn't have the permission to use those skills. There was this separation between what we consider to be educational and what is caring. There's this notion in our field that we're not babysitters and we have to defend the profession. And I always tried to challenge that notion and say, you know, why should we disparage babysitters? You know, caring is an honorable profession. We know that we don't want people to call us babysitters because we are professionals and we have degrees and we've studied and chosen this sort of vocation. But we don't need to separate or make some false distinction between care and education. And really, when you study progressive education and learning, you know that the most meaningful learning comes from that relationship of trust and comfort and being in a place where you can take risks and where you can be playful and where you believe that someone is invested in you. So trying to think back on some of those things, you know, it can be a very, very tangible thing, like just the way you use your body when you're around children, the way you touch children, the way you have sort of an open stance, the way you gesture and smile. I think some of those things are very inherent and learned at a very young age. Because I worked with really, really, really small kids, I was sort of shocked when I went into therapeutic environments and therapists would come in and say, oh, these kids have, you know, short attention span, so we need to work on their IEP goals and we need to get them attending better. So we're going to sit them in chairs and teach them this lesson, and we need to keep them sitting in this chair for 30 minutes. And I would be like, no, this is not how a child develops attention. I didn't really have the rationale to describe what I felt, but I was very, very upset when I saw some of the therapeutic interventions that were applied to children, and just instantly found myself in a sort of advocacy role of saying, no, you know, no three-year-old needs to be sitting in a chair. Three-year-olds learn how to attend by being interested in something. And a three-year-old sitting on my lap playing in the sand is going to, it's going to stick with this for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 minutes. Actually, we are interrupting children's learning. It's just, what are we focusing on? So, I mean, the kind of things, it was songs, singing songs with children. My family had a rich tradition of songs, nursery rhymes, you know, bouncing babies on your knee, spinning kids around. I mean, those very physical visceral things I found myself doing with my kids when I was teaching them, you know, pushing them higher on the swing, pushing, doing underdogs and going under the swing. And like I said, spinning them or doing little, you know, trot, trot to Boston, trot, trot to Maine, bouncing kids on my knees and being in these playful sort of interactive, caring relationships with them. And even when I taught in the public schools, I found that the big kids always wanted to be in my classroom, you know, it would be the songs, it would be the stories, it would be Play-Doh and sand and water, the kind of materials that I found were most engaging for children. The first and second and third graders would, you know, want to be involved in learning in those ways as well. So, I think it's just, it's been interesting to sort of, I don't know, think about how science has validated that, you know, these, you know, take for example, spinning a child or pushing a child on a swing or bouncing a child on your knee, how that develops a child's proprioceptive kind of intelligence and how it develops their sort of core strength and how it develops their reciprocal language. You know, science will tell us now that these things are very important for children. And I think it's sort of an inherited kind of wisdom about how we touch children and how we interact with children that I appreciate from my family. On the other hand, there's plenty of things that happens in my family and in other people's family that we're trying to reject simultaneously as we become intentional educators. And I think that's also an interesting dynamic. You know, there are things as a parent for sure that I don't want to do that my parents did to me. And we want to evolve as humans and find ways to move out of some structures that may have been shaming or punishing or, but I think when you have that foundation of like a parent's love, that first original relationship of care, there is a lot you can return to. And I think it can be a real guiding light for all educators. And I think that, you know, as I've become more interested in that aspect of my work, I have been analyzing care and you know, looking at some of the care ethics research and seeing that some of the philosophers were saying, you know, we need more care ethics in middle school, in high school, in college, and really pounding away at how these institutions we've created are not meeting the needs of young learners. And so it's interesting to me because I'm coming from from working with the babies and toddlers and preschoolers and kind of have that same message. And here the care ethics of people have been trying to give this message to for older kids, for the institutions of you know, high school and college sort of structures and saying that, you know, care ethics can guide us. So it's neat to think that the early sort of wisdom could be pushed up into helping us get grounded about what learning means.
Did you have any, you mentioned that you weren't a good student in school, and I was wondering if you had any particular school memories that stand out, whether moments of challenge or moments that were actually positive, where you felt cared for by a teacher or by someone in the school environment.
Sure. Yeah. My first school memories were really feeling very anxious a lot in school and missing home. I really remember missing home when I went to school, and I don't think I went to kindergarten. I think maybe we had like a half day kindergarten kind of program for a little part where I remembered like trying to take a nap and things like that. So that must've been kindergarten. But I remember first and second grade, mostly feeling really anxious and missing home and being afraid to talk. And I remember being in the cafeteria and talking to someone, and I was scolded. I was scolded by someone who said, "Don't you know the lights are out? We're not supposed to be talking while the lights are out," or something. And that, I just, you know, the fear of a child of being like pointed out. I remember like being in second or third grade and being afraid to tell the teacher I had to go to the bathroom and wetting my pants, you know, just, I did not like it at all. And my little brother was only 18 months younger than me. So we would walk a lot to school. I remember those kind of memories of being with him and again, feeling an incredible sense of responsibility. So I think maybe I must have had like a premature competence that I was sort of caring for other people. And it's hard to learn when you're worried. So I have a lot of empathy for myself now, remembering how much sense of responsibility I was carrying, and you know, not having the freedom to think and to learn and to play, I think was definitely an interfering factor. And then when I got older, I remember being in eighth grade and having a really great teacher. We did move a lot in the in the first, you know, 6, 7, 8 years. And I think when I got in eighth grade, I was with one teacher for the whole time, the whole year. His name was Mr. Perry. And I don't remember a whole lot from that year, but I do remember that, he like called me aside a lot and said, you know, "You're gonna be great, you're gonna be fine, or you're gonna figure this out." And I do remember that he had us keeping journals, and I remember writing in the journal. And he would read our journals. And I think there was like another layer of connection for me there. I do remember we had some sort of history project that we were doing. I think I was, it was like we had to choose characters and choose times, and we had group projects. And I remember building like a log cabin and with a stone fireplace and gathering like little stones and gluing them together. I think it had something to do with pioneer days, or I don't really remember what we were learning, but I think something about having your hands on projects. Even though I was an older child, I was in eighth grade, and having that writing experience. So I had this way of sort of processing. It was like a journal. It wasn't anything that was graded, but it was something we had to write in every day. And he would read it and comment back, not in any sort of judgmental way, but just checking in. And then him pulling me aside and saying, you know, "I believe in you. This, you know, I can see that reading is hard for you, and I know you're going to be fine." That kind of explicit communication.
When was it that you decided that after these experiences, you wanted to go into the field of education?
You know, I think it was because I needed to work and go to college, and I find myself working in caring environments, either with like elder people. Sometimes I would like, I remember one period I was working in like living with a woman. I would just have to go. She hired me to come into her home. I had to be in like by 9 or 10 at night. I was a college student. And sleep through the night. Her family hired me to kind of sleep there through the night and get up and have breakfast with her and then go. So it was an easy job for a college kid. So it was put me in that caregiving role, and then I would find jobs in childcare centers. And I guess those kind of jobs were more attractive to me than working, you know, at the restaurant or doing waitressing. A lot of my friends did that kind of work when they were trying to had a girlfriend who cut hair and a girlfriend who worked in a restaurant. And I always found myself working with children or with elders. And so when I started pursuing, I knew quite early that I wanted to work with young children. But when I started pursuing the degree, there was a lot of, you know, if you want to work with kids, you know, you really should get a degree and you really should work with older kids. Even if you just work with kindergarten and first grade, it would be much more professional and it would be more real teaching. You know, working with young children is not going to give you the kind of salary that you deserve. And you're going to have a hard time paying back your student loans and all that kind of thing. So the advice I was getting was, you know, working with young children is sort of glorified babysitting. It's really nice that you can have that interest, but, and it'll help you in the long run, but you really need to gear towards elementary or older children if you're going to get a degree. So that was sort of the message I got from all my counselors. And luckily, I ended up in Florida for a variety of reasons, and the women in that College of Education were incredible. They were super strong. It was in the University of Florida, and they were just incredible advocates for the early years. And when I was there, they designed a degree that was to get your master's in early intervention. So you would still have sort of a special ed master's degree, but it was really focused on 0 to 5. And they had been sort of pioneers in home visiting and Head Start and early intervention. So it was, I just felt I lucked out because they didn't discourage me from really concentrating on the early childhood development. But I would say that I had, because of sort of growing up in our culture and the advice I'd gotten from so many people, I had this idea that the work I was doing in childcare was not like real teaching, that someday I would like get my master's degree and go on to be a real teacher. So those, I had a lot of conversations with people, friends, colleagues, family members about that. And I just, those conversations really stuck with me, those sort of pivotal, and also feeling a little bit depressed, like, why am I a teacher? You know, I am a thinker, so I want to kind of get back to the why and the purpose. Is it just because I'm a woman? Is it just because I kind of am taking the easy path? This is what I've always done. I'm a big sister. You know, is this really my purpose, or do I just lack imagination? Am I just kind of like, you know, just doing it because it's kind of been almost the life I was born into, taking care of other people, other children from a very young age. So I questioned that a lot, and I had some really great talks with people who said, you know, I had a friend who was a speech therapist, and she had the opposite experience of me. She was saying, I hated the whole idea of caring for anyone. My mom, I was also from a big family like you, and my experience with caring for others was my mom telling me what a burden it was to be a kid, have kids, and how expensive it was to have kids. And you just watch it, someday you're going to have kids and you're going to see that this is no fun and blah, blah, blah. Always complaining about the burden of care and the burden of children and the burden of a family. And she said she grew up with that sort of mantra, and she had a similar path where she completely rejected being a mom, and she completely rejected the caring profession, but at the same time was drawn to it. And she ended up finding a way to study children through language acquisition, and she became a speech therapist. So we had a lot of interesting talks about that. And I had, you know, just other people who told me, you know, some children that are born into circumstances like yours will have that experience of like rejecting care and propel themselves away from this. But there must have been a reason that you felt comfortable and gifted and drawn to that. And I think that studying care ethics helped me a lot. It helped me kind of it helped elevate some of the kind of instinctual feelings I had, you know, about being on the right path. It helped elevate the sort of, it intellectualized it, I guess, and made it more less of a hunch and more of a valid career. And I think because I worked with children with special needs quite a bit at the beginning too. So, you know, children with Down syndrome and autism. And I think that sort of thinking about the life of a disabled person and the type of care and support they're going to need throughout their life and the value of humans, the sort of intrinsic worthiness of humans and what are, I think those kind of relationships revealed to me are inherent dependence upon one another, that we could find ways to view that as a human strength, and that these people with special needs are sort of amplifying that to us, that throughout our life, we're all going to need other people, whether we're a baby and we're vulnerable and we need someone to care for us, whether we're a person with disabilities and we need someone to care for us and assist us and support us, whether we're elders and we need, or we're sick and we're hospitalized. There's always point in everyone's life where they're vulnerable and needing this sort of relation to be in this really dependent relationship. So some of the questions I asked myself led me to that, like I said, that analysis of care ethics, and it kind of made me feel full circle. Like, yes, I really want to do childcare. That's what's most interesting to me and most valuable, I think, also from sort of a feminist ethic and sort of a family ethic. What our family needs now, our families in our country need now, is this sort of understanding of the importance of care. So I don't know, that was kind of circuitous, but
could you share a little bit about the current role that you play in the school that you're at now and kind of how you're integrating all of this learning and knowledge and reflection that you've accrued about the care ethic and all these other things into that work?
Sure. Yeah. So my first sort of full-time directing childcare was at a community college, and that was working with a really different population than I'm working with now. So it was children whose maybe parents were single parents, young parents, parents who were really working to improve their lives, and they were going to community college, and they were able to get grants to have their children in childcare. So it was a subsidized program. So I did a lot of work around grants and helping moms and dads care for their children while they were going to college or working on maybe a vocational degree or something like that. And then from that experience working on a campus, that gave me sort of a good appreciation for what I think of as sort of like, you know, care work has been sort of an infrastructure that creates a strong society, that it's sort of invisible work. People don't think about it. People can say, oh, this is so amazing that we have this community college program where these people, these women, these men can improve their lives. But no one usually sort of peels that back and looks at, yeah, this person had a baby and this person, you know, couldn't get a job because they couldn't get childcare or this person was, you know, not able to afford education. So all the layers of things that allow a person to step up and evolve and improve their lives are very close to their heart, close to their family needs. So care is one of those sort of embedded, it's like nested within our ability to bolster ourselves. We need to feel that someone is caring for us and our children. And so that kind of gave me this idea about infrastructure and a care grid. And I started reading a lot about sort of the care advocacy that's happening for domestic workers, for elders, and feeling my connection with that. And it's something that wasn't promoted in the profession of early childhood education, because in early childhood education, when I would attend sort of seminars, symposiums, directors, leadership institutes, they would say, do not talk about care. They would say, talk about education. What you're doing is learning. It is education. It is more than care. And if you only talk about care, people are just going to think you're a babysitter. You need to adopt this language of the academic, talk about math and science and literacy, show how children are learning when you care for them, when they're playing. So I got kind of good at speaking that language, but it really never felt right to me. It felt very artificial and unauthentic. I could tell you why this child is digging in the sandbox, that he is gaining all these motor skills and that is helping his brain develop, and he's learning about textures and full and empty and all this language and vocabulary and cause and effect, but it just seems silly to me. It's like, we are humans. Can we just play and care for the sake of playing and caring and being alive? Do we have to, you know, sort of pin these standards on everything and sort of commodify children and education for this future goal? So I understand why that message is well-intentioned and why educators have to talk in those terms, but I did really reject it. So then after doing the childcare at Dutchess and I moved to Bard, I just felt like this is a more academic environment. These are, professors mostly. I'm mostly working with professors and people who have a lot of flexibility, but I have a lot of pressure on them, young families. And it just kind of, they did not, they were an intellectual crowd, but they were not putting the pressure on me to rationalize and define why kids need to play and why kids need to paint and why kids need to be cared for. They seem to get it, you know, like let kids be kids. And it seemed like that gave me some freedom to start talking more about care as a pedagogy, as an ethic, and paying attention to the kind of things that are important to parents. Having conversations with parents more and more about sort of routines and rituals and connections and relationships, those sort of things were able to be the primary focus of my conversations with parents, rather than, is he learning his ABCs? Is he, you know, going to be ready for kindergarten? It seemed to me more about sort of what is right and good for children and how do we create a child's habitat. And I just kept finding a language for what I described as a pedagogy and practice of care. And so, like I said, because I had been thinking about these things, I began writing about it a lot. So one of my goals for moving to Bard was because it is a smaller school, and I felt like I would have more time to develop this this goal of mine to write down everything that was so present. I knew that I couldn't, when I was at the community college, I had a chance to move into sort of administrative role, working with college students and helping them get ready to become teachers. But I didn't feel like I would have sort of the muse, you know, the children and the families. And I felt like I needed that to continue my work directly with children and families and for the kind of writing I was doing. So I've been writing for about 7 or 8 years on sort of this pedagogy and practice of care and studying care ethics, and the families of Bard have been a great dialogue. The dialogue with them has really, the conversation with them has helped me solidify sort of what what I want to say. You don't really, you know, you want to say something, but you don't, you can't really get it out there until you start having those conversations with people about what you believe in.
How has it been over the last 5 months navigating how to care for your students and learners?
Yeah, it's been really hard. And I think, you know, the teachers have had a lot of grief and a lot of resistance to you know, some of the mandates, the mask wearing. The mask wearing is one that brings a lot of grief up for all of us, because we know how much children depend upon our smile, our facial expressions, our lips for articulation, language development. So we've had a lot of conversations about that and how to care for children in safe ways. And I think it just keeps coming back to sort of faith in children and we've, you know, developed ways to talk to kids and families honestly about why we have to wear masks and who we are behind the masks and all the ways we have to stay connected, sort of thinking about you know, the emotional intelligence of children, the intra and interpersonal intelligence of children, the existential intelligence of children. You know, like, kids sense it. They sense your connection. They know. They feel your connection. Like, maybe this is a time to heighten some of that trust that we have in one another. Maybe this is a time to move much more slowly. For our own self-care, because wearing a mask is hard, and for the care of children and families, we're going to have to, you know, sort of develop some signs and some symbols and some ways of being together that are new, and it can be hard and frustrating, and we can feel a lot of resistance towards that, but for the time being, we can also recognize the opportunity, and we can recognize that there are going to be windows of learning, and there are going to be opportunities to talk about things we haven't talked about in the past. So the mask wearing, the distance learning is really hard, especially for us who believe in play and relationships and getting messy, hands-on, and actually have a screen-free approach. So the things that parents need most from us, we can't help them with. We can't really physically be there to care for their children. So that is, like, really hard, and parents are going bonkers. But again, it's given us an opportunity, you know, even on our Zoom calls, when we're doing songs and stories and conversations with children, parents are listening. And none of that connection that we've maintained through Zoom would have ever been possible unless we would have already had that grounding. So we already had this trusting, grounding relationship with children, and then we were able to find ways to continue it. It didn't continue with all children. All children couldn't do it. Some kids, their parents were just saying, you know, they're in a little bubble, they're playing in the backyard with their brother, I'm not going to interrupt them, because when they see you, they feel sad, and they start asking questions about school. So every family negotiated it in a different way. And some teachers have done some beautiful, beautiful things that they never thought they would do. I have a kindergarten teacher friend who is doing all sorts of amazing storytelling with children, one-on-one, over Zoom. And they are telling her stories, and she's writing down their words, and she's reading the stories back to them, and she's including the families in the stories. And then the next time they meet, she has the story all published and has added to it, because another child told a similar story, and she's making books that she can then send out to the families of the children's stories. And so she's having tea parties with small groups of kids. You know, people have have said that there's a new triad that's coming up, and it's the parent-child teacher triad that we talk about, but we need each other more than ever before now. The parents and the teachers need each other really desperately, so we have to find ways to be communicating like we never have before. Of course, through all this, we all are heartbroken for the families who don't have either the technology to connect or don't have the means, the time. There are so many families who are in survival mode right now. And we know there are so many families who are suffering and kids who are neglected and abused during the pandemic. So whenever we talk about sort of the silver lining and the opportunities and learning, I always feel very conscious of the people who do not see any silver lining right now. There's a big group of kids and families who do not see any silver lining whatsoever. You know, some parents are like, "Wow, this is great. We're spending more time with our kids. We're spending more time outside." And as we prepare to reopen, we're also like, the things that we value most are going to be more present. We're going to be outside all the time. We're going to be playing. We're going to be connecting. Some of the things that are going to have to be put on the shelf or perhaps never come back into our practice are things that we don't need. So that dualistic kind of like crisis and opportunity is a strange territory to navigate, because it's not by any means trying to be like Pollyannish and optimistic, but we do find lots of joy and lots of bright spots. So that's what's going to carry us forward, I suppose.
Is there, in thinking about these relationships, I would love to hear a little bit more about what you're learning from the way that this relationship between parent and teacher and student is shifting, or learning new things, maybe leaving old things behind.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard teachers describe in some ways, the very minute detail, like the teacher who's transcribing the children's words and telling a story on Zoom, and the parent is close by, you know. So the kid says, the dinosaur went outside and stepped on the volcano. And the teacher writes, the dinosaur went outside and stepped on a volcano. Is that what you want to say? And the child says, yes. And no, change it. And then I want to say this. And then the teacher reads it back to the child. Some of those practices that we have of listening to children, writing down their words, pausing, clarifying. Parents have said, you know, you always wrote down the children's stories, but I never saw the process before. And then we have a chance to talk about, like, we want to say back exactly what the child says, because we want to validate that we heard them and that their language is important. And we want to pause, and we don't want to use our words, but we might have a good question that helps the child think. So once you start having a conversation with a parent about something as simple as how to transcribe a child's story, it opens up so many opportunities that could be sort of helpful to the parent-child relationship. I've had a lot of parents ask me, like, how do I promote independence? My child is very needy and they want me to play with them all the time and I need to get stuff done. You know, how do I promote independence? And again, it finds us talking about very specific strategies that I think can really help the parent-child relationship and be sort of lifelong strategies. So I found myself talking about things that I maybe had used general terms before, you know, like you need to promote your child's independence without giving a lot of specifics how to do that. So coaching parents over the phone, like, okay, you know, your child is playing and your child is pretending. You put out some props that you think are going to be intriguing. You know, you put out that little tub of water and a sponge and a couple plastic toys, and now your child is engaging. And how do you let play and let presence be? How do you practice listening? You know, we have a tendency to want to respond every time a child says something or does something. And then we teach the children to be like sort of ping pong, which is healthy. You know, that's how conversation works. But I mean, I think it's a lot of what you're practicing with the oral history is pausing and letting silence be, not throwing the ball back right away, seeing where the child will go next. I mean, you could put an analogy to like a child learning how to move. Like if you put the toys around the child and the child can't crawl yet, the child's going to learn how to roll over and grab that toy. And then the toy accidentally gets out of the child's reach. But if you run over and push the toy back to the child's reach, the child is not going to learn how to scoot his body over to that toy. So it's this very delicate interaction that is care, I think, because we want to promote the child's independence. And we also want to give the child the sense that we care, we're watching, we're there, we're supporting. And I think those kind of like really subtle practices have we've had to talk about them a little bit more. And the parent would say, oh, you know, like maybe my approach about listening to children and pausing and waiting and watching children before I step in to help them, parents have interpreted that as sort of permissive and following the child, letting the child do whatever he wants. And I'm like, no, that's not what I mean. So there's been a lot of clarification, you know, like how do we, and there's been a more time for parents and teachers to get real and say, you know, this is hard. This is really hard stuff. And more of an appreciation for care, that daily care, you know, around meal times, around bath times. And I've been saying to a lot of parents, I do not like this whole idea of quality time. Like, I just don't like this idea that, you know, it's quality time, not quantity time. And you have to have this quality experience with your child. And I don't like that pressure, because if you have meals together every day, it's something about the quantity. It's something about the routine. It's something about the repetitiveness. It isn't always going to feel great. It isn't going to feel quality. You're not always going to feel connected. But because you've had that meal together every day, you're building something. So it is, it's more quality. It's more quantity. Quantity. And they have a lot of quantity right now. So I don't know. There's just lots more, I guess, deeper, because we've all been thrown into it. It's that sort of immersion. It's the immersion experience between parent and teacher, I think.
What has life been like for you outside of school?
Oh, it's been hard. It's been hard. I have teenagers and I've had, you know, they're very different kids. So I have one teenager who just is graduating from high school. He's done really, really well. He's loved the online. He excelled. He, you know, did really great with all his courses and got into a good college. And he's done it all online, which has been crazy. My other son has really struggled with the online, and he's hated it. He has barely shown up. He barely passed any of his classes because he just pretty much checked out. And I just couldn't nag him anymore. So it's been interesting to think about how his high school will progress. And I've actually had a lot of guilt as a parent for not staying on top of it and I've had to let go. And with the teenager, they close their bedroom door and they're in there with their screens, you know. So it's like I you have to live, you have to give up control, but usually they're in the world with their friends and, you know, but here we are quarantined. So I've had to give up some control and try to let go of some guilt. And surprisingly, you know, he's my younger son who I've been more worried about has, you know, I've learned that there's a couple things he's been working on. One is he's been working on keyboarding, and he's like up to 120 words a minute typing. So it's like, okay, he wasn't just playing video games. He was actually working on his keyboard skills, and he likes to write. So this is good. And he also has been learning Japanese, which I had no idea. And so he's showing me all these different programs that are teaching him all the phonetic symbols and sounds and how he's mastered all, I don't remember, 46 Japanese symbols and the different systems and things that he's trying to learn about. So that gave me a sort of a breath, like, okay, we have to let our kids be sometimes, and they have to be managing their own time when they're teenagers. We can't be dictating this or getting into power struggles with them, and we have to have some faith. You know, if he got bored enough or burned out enough, he somehow found something that was a little more purposeful than the video games I was worried about. And then my father is dying, so that's been really, really hard. And my father is in Nevada, and he's had cancer, and he's, you know, so just the isolation of having an elder parent. And he's had to go into the hospital a few times for a crisis, and not being able to communicate with him, not being able to help him. And they just let him out of the hospital very prematurely, because in Nevada, the COVID is spiking, and there's the hospital beds are at a premium. So they sent him home with oxygen, with a catheter, with a wheelchair. So my mom and my sister is there right now trying to care for him, and just seeing his decline and his isolation. He has a twin sister and a brother who have died in the last month, and he's grieving and he's lonely, and we can't, you know, support them because of the travel restrictions and the various isolation issues. So I understand that many, many, many elders and people who need medical intervention are suffering right now. And it's hard. It's very hard. And all this, all that, everyone has that in the background, because I've been working pretty much nonstop with my teachers and parents and BARD and reopening and all the plans that we have in place to get our school opened up in August. So I know that everyone, I always think of that, everyone that I'm on Zoom with has a lot of stuff going on in their homes with their families. And I'm always hopeful that in the midst of a crisis, that we can make a big shift. We can make a big shift as a society, as a nation, and start to value and appreciate the sort of family dynamic and the care that we all have been kind of told this our own problem. It's a private matter, and it's not really a private matter. It's a public good. If people could feel that they were cared for, it would benefit. It would make a stronger society, but we've generally been told to figure it out, and it's a private matter. Care is a private matter. So there must be something about this isolation and all of us being in each other's houses and bedrooms, and where we start to appreciate the private matter is really a public good.
You've mentioned this word faith a few times and the importance of faith in this moment. And I'm wondering what the relationship is between faith and your understanding of care.
That's a good question. I think when I say faith, I mean trust as well. It's not imposing my will on someone else. So care would be like a conversation, and you say something, and then you have to sort of take a leap of faith because you don't know what's going to come back at you. You know, you don't know what's going to come back. You have to have faith that that person is their own person, and whatever comes back is sort of the material you have to respond to or to make a decision or on. So there's this place between humans that is about faith. I was reading a poem by David White, and he talks about like this, the frontier of a conversation. Like, you don't know where it's going. You know, if it's a true conversation, you can't direct it. And I think that that's true with care. You can have goals, even if you think about the very basic stuff about what your kids are going to eat or how you're going to train them to use the toilet, or, you know, you can have goals, but it's always a bit of it's always original. It's always unique to the individual. It's always this very special dynamic between you and another person that is not replicated, that has no script. It's I guess having faith is like this ability to walk in the dark, to take a first step, to not know where the conversation is going, but to trust that humans are full, capable, complete beings, and they have sort of their own direction, that we all have an internal locus, that we have agency. So I guess it's that sort of partnership of dependency, a partnership of dependency that's healthy, that's a healthy dependency. It's not entangled. It respects the other. It has boundaries. There's a boundary between me and you, and a boundary between me and my child. No matter how much I love my child, there's faith that they have to find their way. I can certainly support, and I can be a mirror. I can be a boundary. I can be a fence. I can serve so many roles in that relationship, but ultimately I am not that person. The process is theirs. So that's, I guess, what I think of when I say faith. It feels good to articulate it.
We're coming towards the end of the interview, and I just have a couple more questions that I wanted to ask. And one is, you mentioned a hope for this shift towards care. And I'm wondering what is needed to shift towards care, and what is in the way of a shift towards care?
Well, I mean, it's attitudinal shifts, you know, like moving from sort of this, I guess what we'd call a domination kind of hierarchy. Care has been at the bottom of the hierarchy. So an attitudinal shift where you see care is at the hub, you know, care is central care. It's not a hierarchy. It's not a ranking. I think that kind of, I guess, moving from domination to partnership. And then that has to be adjusting our systems, our economic systems. It has to be, the value has to be reflected. So what, you know, I'm borrowing some language from Rianne Eisner right now. She talks about what is the true wealth of a nation. You know, how do we recalculate wealth and strength? How do we put value on care and education and these things that we've thought of, like I said, like a private matter, or things that we thought of soft skills, things that have been always present, but have been, because they've been in the domain of women primarily, have been invisible, expected, assumed. So it's a big economic adjustment. Money is a big part of it, right? I mean, most people who care for a profession are also eligible for public assistance because they can't pay the bills. So there's a big economic adjustment. I know there's room for it. I know there, it's not a lack of funds. It's what we spend our money on is the question. So, I'm reading The Wealth of a Nation right now by Ryan Wisner, and she has some pretty specific initiatives, which are, it's not really the world I exist in very well with the policies and economic reform, but there is a movement towards universal care that would provide for those people with disabilities and those people with long-term care needs and children, and ways to reevaluate the kind of taxes we pay and the kind of credits we get depending on the care needs of families. There's a, you know, right now we're surviving on a business model which can't sustain care. That's, you know, so it's confusing. Like, why, if care costs so much, it costs so much to go into nursing home, it costs so much to get quality child care, it costs so much. So parents and are paying so much. So why are teachers and caregivers earning so little? It's just because there is no equation in that triad that works in a business model. There has to be a subsidy. There has to be a value that is woven into sort of the infrastructure of how our economy works as a community, as a society.
Care can't be a business.
No, exactly.
So as we come to the end of the interview, I do want to ask you if there's anything else that you'd like to say now, even if it's just so that you, so it's for yourself, so that you remember something.
I just think it's been incredibly nourishing to talk about these things. And I think for me, I've been writing a lot, and I've been keeping it very close. And it's very nourishing to be able to have someone hold a space. So thank you for doing that. And I would like to be able to do that for other people. I'd like us all to be able to have spaces where we feel listened to. And I think it's more important to say what we believe in now, you know, and to say it over and over again, because sometimes we forget ourselves. So thank you.
Thank you. I feel like I've learned a lot too.
Yeah, you've been a great interviewer.
So I will stop the recording now, but you can stay on.
Okay.